Well, Nick, that was approximately 2 hours and 45 minutes of our lives that we'll never get back. I'm pretty sure we don't get that back at any point. The Blue Jays trailed 2-0 entering the fifth inning, and they exited that same inning trailing 9-0. Like, there was hope of a comeback at some point, but unfortunately that fifth inning was the backbreaker. The Jays are now 1-5 against the Rays so far this season. They are now 2 games under 500, 25-27, following a 13-0 loss to wrap up a series sweep in Florida.
I mean, it was dismal. It was an abomination. Use whatever you adjective you want. Break out your thesaurus. This is about as bad as it gets in a single game. Now, does having a terrible single game mean that the season is ruined and that you have to think every player on the field is a terrible player? Absolutely not. But this was undoubtedly a brutal performance. Before the game, we talked about, you know, what you could say about Chris Bassitt. He's not always dominant, but he always gives you a decent start. We said he always gives you 5 innings this season. He's never given up more than 4 runs. Well, this is the time when he broke that pattern, and then the guys who came in after him did not help. There was some really ugly feeling in the corners. George Springer ended up without an error somehow in the box score in this game, but he had a really, really tough time out there. Nathan Lucas, when he came into the game, he had that error, which ultimately led to 4 unearned runs. The lineup did absolutely nothing. I'm going to give a little bit of credit to Vladimir Guerrero Jr.
This is not the day for that, Nick.
1-for-2 with a walk and 2 of the 3 hardest hit balls in the game. He was not incredible, but he literally did his job. The rest of the lineup, 3-for-27 with no walks. And every single one of those 3 hits was a single, and one of those singles resulted immediately in a pickoff. Mm. That is what the lineup did today. It's hard to know what to say about it because it is the type of performance that undoubtedly they simply want to forget about. There is nothing positive to really draw from this game. Michael Stefanik, surprisingly good as a pitcher. It's his second big league outing. 2 scoreless innings now. No major league hitters have managed to do any damage against him. He lives in the high 50s, low 60s with that slider. Looked pretty efficient out there, but other than that, wow.
Yeah, Michael Stefanik coming in and immediately setting down 1-2-3, and then in the very next half inning getting a hit was by far the highlight of this game.
I mean, sprinkle of Ohtani right there.
Shohei who? Yeah, Michael Stefanik. When that's what you focus on for even more than 10 seconds, I think you know what kind of a game you were watching. You're listening to Jays Talk, of course. Show Ali, Nick Ashbourn with you. We're live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. We're also streaming on sportsnet.ca and on the Sportsnet app. You can give us a call, 416-870-0590, 1-888-666-0590, *590 on your cell. You can text us as well, 590-590, name and location. The People's text line is always open. Standard messaging and data rates may apply. You know, maybe I was thinking this because the Oilers game is going on right now, and it started much earlier, right? But it's about 90 minutes ago. And, you know, maybe because hockey was on, but there's some like horrifying synergy between the Jays and another Toronto team in the Leafs, in that like anytime they give you even the slightest bit of hope that things might be turning the corner, they go and immediately dunk on you for believing that this time things will be different. I mean, maybe I just have some lingering trauma based on how the Leafs season ended, but I admit, went right after, I think it was before I got to 13-0, right after the fifth inning, I thought to myself, that definitely crossed my mind.
I have a group chat with a couple of friends, and one recurring joke in that chat is people keep asking, like, can the Blue Jays get over 500? Will that happen for the rest of the season? And they kept getting close and falling back. They actually did it.
They
did it against the Padres with that sweep against a quality team at home where the offense really came to the fore and did a good job. And so it looked like we're over the hump here a little bit. And then suddenly this series in Tampa Bay, where they didn't even give themselves a chance realistically with what they did on offense. And we referred to some of the pitching they saw earlier, and they saw good pitching in this game as well. But at a certain point, like, you need to produce, you need to grind out a few runs. Even if the pitching is good, you need to grind out a few runs. 1 run, 0 run, is simply do not give yourself a chance. Like Bassitt, there was a moment in this game where it kind of felt like he might sort of escape with a half decent out. Like, he was working in and out of trouble the whole time, but it seemed like he could find a pitch when he needed it and the defense could bail him out. And before the fifth inning explosion, you kind of thought, you know what? Maybe he's kept them in this game a little bit. But actually, he hadn't, because the offense was so bad that giving up two runs in the first had already ended the game. And that's just like, that's not going to be a place from which you're going to be able to go on the run that they need to go on to get over that hump, be consistently over 500, be the team competing for the wild card that is the goal this season.
Yeah, I really do think that this is largely who this team is. And I don't, what I mean by that, I don't mean by a team that is like bad enough to lose 13-0 every game, but more a team that is going to experience the highs of sometimes sweeping teams, the 14-0 win in there, as they did with the Padres, and then experience the lows of losing like this they did today to wrap up a series sweep against a divisional opponent, right? Like, that is kind of what it is. To your point about being a 500 team, like, that kind of is what it means to be a 500 team, right? Like, you get some really high highs, you get some real low lows. And I mean, I said this before a million times at this point, it feels like, but like, this team is going to hover between 2 and 3 games above or below 500 more or less all season. And I'm not really sure I've seen anything to believe that that's not going to be the case, because again, I don't think they're this bad all the time, but they're also not 14-0 being the Padres good every time either.
Well, no one is this bad all the time. If you're this bad all the time, you're not a major league franchise, to be honest. I know what you mean, where there might be stretches that might get on a big winning streak at some point, but based on the talent on the roster, you know, you can even start in the rotation, right? Like, they had one of the guys, arguably the guy they were most confident who went today, and they still got absolutely blown out. Yeah, yeah. But you've got a fifth spot that is very much up in the air. Eric Lauer's given them, you know, something a little bit interesting, but he's not someone you consider a consistent starter at this point in his career. Bowden Francis has been, you know, pretty brutal for most of the season. And so, like, that's the starting point for that consistency, is you're putting out someone on the mound who you think will keep the game in order, give you a chance to win. And from that point, you still have to do something on offense. But the Jays don't even really have that starting point in the rotation where they can go into a game, feel confident that they're not going to fall behind early by a significant margin. Now, obviously, that happened in this game. That's happened in a lot of Bowden Francis starts. It happened in the Berríos game as well. And, right, you know, he's someone who is looking a little bit shaky and had, you know, rough velocity his last outing. We'll see where that goes. But the strength of this team is right now, I think it's sort of the bullpen and defense. And neither of those things help you get out in front of games. In both of those situations, you're putting yourself in a position where it's likely that the other team is going to get the jump on you. And again, we saw that in this series. It's always hard to come back, but it's even harder when your offense is, you know, if we're being generous, middle of the pack.
And in a game like this, when you lose 13-0, your bullpen and defense also didn't really show up.
Defense certainly did not show up. I will say a little bit of grace for Mason Fluharty, because he's had a rough outing. His ERA went from 2.14 to 3.46. Four runs came in on him. But the average exit velocity against him was 77.6, which is like way, way, way below average. Balls were not getting hit hard against him. They were falling in against him. It was just one of those nightmare days. I don't think he was outstanding, but if you look at where he threw his pitches, like, he did hug the corners at times. He did a lot of the stuff that's worked for him in the past. He just had one of those times where it's simply not your day. So as a guy who's still trying to establish himself, this is not the type of outing where I see him and think, oh, I trust him less. He deserves less of a role because of this blow up. You know, he had the out at the plate not happen. Again, experienced some of the Springer's difficulties in right field. I think he'll ultimately be okay, even though this is a really, really unpleasant box score for him to look at. Again, this is me trying to spin a positive out of a guy who did not record a single out. So you can take that for what it's worth.
Yeah, it was a tough outing for Fluharty, right? 3 hits, 4 runs, all of which were earned. A walk in there as well, which was a walk that scored a run. Yeah, that was the 50-50 play on the tag attempt. I tend to think he was safe. Not a great throw from Ernie Clement. Not a great tag attempt as well at the dish. He gives the hit to Chandler Simpson. He walks the run. Bases loaded single to Rortfett. That scores 2 runs. Paxton Schultz comes in. And then kind of a tough break. You mentioned George Springer, the misplay in the sun. Another run scores on Fluharty's ledger there. It was a tough watch, but I'm with you. It wasn't a lot that was hit particularly hard. Having said that, that is a small comfort when you do lose it five is a very double digit runs.
The only comforts available to us at this moment are small comforts. Let's be clear.
I think that's fair. This is from Sportsnet Stats before we go to the phones. Wednesday, Blue Jays matched the record for the largest home shutout victory in franchise history. So that was the 14-0 win over the Padres. Sunday, the Blue Jays suffered their third largest road shutout margin of defeat in franchise history. So there you go. So a tale of two teams, tale of some real high highs and some really low lows when it comes to what we got today. 416-870-0590, 1-888-666-0590, *590 on your cell. We'll go to the text line in a sec, 590-590, name and location. But first, let's go to the phones, and let's go to Alan in Toronto, who joins us here on Jays Talk. Alan, what's on your mind?
And they reversed their field, didn't they? Toronto 14, San Diego nothing on Wednesday. And they shut out the Padres the night before, too. 2-0, and Padres are one of the most dangerous teams in baseball, one of the most dangerous hitting teams. So the only thing you can expect is the unexpected. Texas Rangers are 3 games under .500, so I give the Jays a good chance. And the last at bat for Santander, 11 pitch at bat in a hopeless situation. You have to give hats off to him. And there's two sides to every story, too. There always is. Tampa Bay pitched their lights out today, and all you hear is the Jays, they left their bats in the cold storage room. There's two sides to every story. And Chris Bassitt gave up 9 hits and 5 runs. Why don't you just say that Tampa Bay went to the lumberyard, 13 runs on 15 hits. There are two sides to every story. You know, it's that's baseball for you. You can't just blame the Jays. Why don't you give credit to the Rays?
Yeah, hey, Alan, thanks for the call. I appreciate you joining us. And I think that's like a valid point, right? I mean, you can't only crush one team. I mean, sometimes pitchers pitch well and sometimes hitters hit. They get paid millions of dollars too, just like the Jays do. But I think the reason for me, and I'm guessing the reasons a lot of texters and callers tend to focus on the negative is because it does feel like somewhat of a pattern when you take into the previous years all into account as well. Having said that, I mean, like, I just, on a day like today, like, nothing went right, right? I tend to believe you just throw it all out. But like Bassitt, for example, to use that, because we haven't really gone too in-depth on Bassitt, he just looked like he was really laboring, right? Maybe the heat was an issue. Like, I don't actually know. We'll have to hear what they say afterwards. Bassitt usually, you know, takes accountability for those kinds of things. So I'm curious to see what he says. But I mean, he gives up the home run to Lau in the first inning. He had a lot of traffic most innings. And he also wasn't helped by extremely quick outings from the Blue Jays bats either, right? I mean, like, and by no means blaming this on any one player, because, again, you can't when you lose 13-0. But, I mean, after that gruesome fifth inning, I have to imagine basically everyone reacted the exact same way you and I both did, which was you see a 7-run fifth inning from the Rays bats, and then Bobichet comes up and swings the first pitch, and sends it right to right field for the first out, like, what, seconds after the game comes back from commercial break? So, again, by no means is it on Bobichet, but there were a lot of those kinds of moments in this inning and in this game, pardon me, and it doesn't seem to have helped Bassitt on a day he was already laboring quite a lot.
I think it's right that there are two sides to every story, and that is something we got into a little bit in the pregame show and how good the Rays pitching had been. This one does feel a little bit different for a couple of reasons. I mean, one of them is that the Rays were not actually smacking the ball around the ballpark that much. There was that home run in the first, but as I mentioned earlier, Vladdy had two of the three hardest hit balls in the game. Like, it wasn't like they were constantly shooting rockets around. We talked about Nathan Lucas making that error in left, a couple of balls, and, you know, the wind did seem to be a factor and the sun did seem to factor. Like, the conditions were legitimately difficult, but both teams were dealing with those conditions. And so, you know, the adventures that Springer had in right, not just the one, there were a couple potentially catchable that fell in. And so when balls are kind of falling in like that and the defense isn't necessarily doing its job, that's when I think it's fairer to point to the Jays and say they are culpable for this loss, as opposed to the Rays have done something extraordinary and we have to tip our caps to them. Obviously, the Rays did some things right in this game. There's no two ways about it. Even a Jays lineup that, as I said, generously you could call middle of the road, holding that lineup to no extra base hits, like, that's a legitimate accomplishment. They deserve some credit for that. But that line of thinking for me fits more with the previous two games in the series. With this game, I just don't think the Blue Jays gave themselves a chance. Also, the Santander thing, that is worth a note. A guy coming up with absolutely no chance to make a difference in this game, hot day, could easily want to go home. Someone who has actually had some injury trouble recently, going to a day game the next day, sort of mailing in that at bat, or at least just sort of being swinging aggressively and seeing where the chips fall, that would have been a very easy thing to do. And he worked an 11-pitch at bat, did not go his way in the end. He struck out. But I do think that that's a little bit of a demonstration of grit, which is something that's not always the easiest to see in baseball, but he did show that.
So we're saying Stefanik won and Santander's final IB of the game two as the lone positives from a 13-0 defeat.
And a half-decent day from Vladdy before
okay,
they pulled
right.
up.
Okay, I'll put
that's
I'll
three.
Vladdy.
There's
I'll
your three stars
three.
Of the game.
Yeah, those are the three stars, exactly. 590-590, name and location is the text line. Russ and Kingston saying, this team, and I'm just going to assume this is correct from Russ before I can't fact check it on the go here, but Russ saying this team really hates weekends. They're 5-13 on the weekend with a -33 run differential. Weekdays, they are 20-14 with a +6 run differential. You know, that sounds, I'll say this, it sounds right to me because I do all the Jays talks on the weekends and Blair and Barker largely do the Jays talks during the week. So that sounds about right to me for Russ's math there.
For now, I'm going to have to call that a statistical oddity. Sometimes these things happen and there's actually a structural reason why a team is better or worse in a certain situation. I think back, this is going to be an odd reference, but I think back to Josh Hamilton and him performing really well in night games and poorly in day games. And then they learned later on that his eyes had a heavy sensitivity to light. This was a player who was like an MVP caliber offensive force for a brief window in his career.
Right, right.
And he had these amazing numbers at night, and during the day they were terrible because his eyes had sensitivity to light. So in those bright days in the afternoon, he actually really struggled to pick up the ball and perform as well. And I don't think there's anything real and structural happening with the Blue Jays. I don't think there's some unbelievable party team, for instance, that shows up to the ballpark and immensely hungover and is unable to do their jobs. For now, I think it's a statistical quirk, but it's an interesting one to point out.
Before we wrap up on Bassett and get back to the calls too, I don't want to forget this. So we saw more, and you pointed this out to me during the game, but we saw a lot more of like the quote unquote hard stuff from Bassett today than maybe we usually do. I mean, by the end of his outing, and again, he only went four innings. So it wasn't like he threw as many pitches as he usually does, but four plus innings, I guess if you want to consider it that way. But Bassett threw 34 sinkers. He threw 28 cutters and every other pitch was under 10, right? He threw 9 curves, 6 splitters. The curve and splitter, I feel like you tend to see a little bit more than 9 and 6. He threw 2 sweepers, 2 four-seamers, 1 slider. Not too much of a surprise for those ones. But were you surprised ultimately by the end of this game when it comes to the pitch mix? Because I feel like we do often see, like in the best Bassett starts, you see the hard stuff followed by a lot of the soft stuff, like a 91-mile-an-hour sinker followed by a 71-mile-an-hour curveball. And I feel like we didn't get to see that too much today.
There was a concerted effort, and I don't know if it comes from Bassett or Sanchez or the team scouting staff, whatever, but the way it played out, there was definitely a concerted effort for him to establish those pitches. And maybe his idea was that later in the game, he would go to the soft stuff, and that just never happened
because
he didn't last in the game. But some of what's been most effective for him this season has been that really slow curveball, has been that sweeper, which is, again, like living in the mid-low 70s. And it's part of what makes him different. Like, there's not a lot of pitchers that have that. And so it's a look that hitters right now just are not used to timing up, and it's been really effective. And it was definitely underutilized in this game. The first 13 pitches of the game were all sinker, cutter, fastball. And I don't know for sure if that played a role in the Brendan Lau home run, but it might have. He might have seen people before him just see sinker, 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 cutter, and time himself up for that. And I think Bassett probably could have helped himself by, you know, dropping a couple of those curveballs in early just to keep that in the hitters' minds. It didn't work out this time. Like, trying to follow what Bassett is doing in a given start is always difficult because he got so many pitches, and some of them are probably going and not going on a given day. But this is an instance where you can kind of pick up the fact that there wasn't a lot of breaking balls here, and you can definitely intuit that things might have gone slightly differently if the pitch mix had been a bit more balanced.
The cutter, too, that he threw to Lau, didn't really cut either. And so when you're throwing a cutter that doesn't have the regular movement on it, and he left it over the middle, you're kind of just throwing a ball that hangs in there. And he threw it at 87 miles an hour or so. I mean, of all people to do that to, Brandon Lau also. I mean, Brandon Lau, by the way, also quickly climbing up the list of Blue Jays killers, the players who enjoy being the Blue Jays daddy. I mean, he hit his 20th career home run off a Blue Jays pitcher in his 61st game started against him. That is a truly ludicrous pace. 20 home runs in 61 games.
I always find those stats very bizarre because obviously it's different pitchers along the way. We know that he's had a lot of success against Bassett in particular, yeah. But when you say Blue Jays pitchers, that could mean anybody a course of years. So I'd have to believe that that has something to do with the ballpark. Like he probably obviously didn't. This is a new ballpark in this particular game, but I bet you that he enjoys hitting at Rogers Center. He just picks up the ball well there, and it suits his swing because, yeah, there's a huge difference between facing Chris Bassett and Brendan Little and Yariel Rodriguez and all the guys you could conceivably be facing.
Yeah, versus like, you know, Tyler Chatwood or something like that. Not to pick on him in particular, but just the name that came to the top of mind.
It was a tough Blue Jays tenure for him. Like, let's be honest.
416-870-0590, 1-888-666-0590, *590 on your cell. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Joe in Mississauga. Joe, welcome to Jays Talk. What's on your mind?
Hey, guys. I've been watching the Jays since their inception, and I'll tell you, the last few years, Tampa game plan against the Jays, it seems to be perfect all the time. It doesn't matter if Tampa's in a slump, if they're on a run, they just play the Jays perfectly. So obviously the coaches get together and they have a game plan. Jays, on the other hand, with all those coaches, all those analytic people that they have, are lost. And I don't get it. But Tampa, it's so frustrating. And I look at this team and I look at all those coaches and I'm thinking, that inning that Bassett had a rough go, I think you guys spoke about it a bit. But in my mind, I've coached Little League, obviously. But, I mean, so you tell a kid, you know, take a pitch. Eh? Your pitcher's dying out there. He had a tough inning. But, no, major league pitchers, major league hitters go up there. And I think it was 4 pitches and 3 outs. I mean, if Bassett's not disgusted with those players or with the coaches that couldn't walk up to Bichette. I think it was Bichette, that catcher, Sanchez. I think the last guy, was it Straw? Couldn't go up and say, hey, guys, take a couple pitches. Are you kidding? Like I'm so done with the Jays and all the nonsense, especially the coaches. And I see Encarnacion in there, the hitting instructor, helping them. Like, I love Edwin. But nothing seems to be working. I don't get it. Like, hey. I don't get it. And I really put the blame on. I still do. With the coaches on up. I'm sorry. That's my little rant.
No.
It just bothers me. I couldn't watch. My wife goes, are you still watching? So at that point, it was, I tell you, the score was 4-0. I said, you know what? I'm shutting it off. I got some stuff to do. I turn on the radio and I hear Straw's playing second base and I go, oh my God. I go, this is, they have to fire. I would only keep Walker. I'd fire everybody. That's my take.
All right. Thank you, Joe. Yeah. I appreciate the call. Thanks for joining us here on Jays Talk. Yeah. I'm actually surprised we haven't gotten that many fire John Schneider takes and fire more people takes, I should say. After a game like this, but like, I'll say this before we get into that, he mentioned analytics and I'll just say, I do think, you know, I'm not sure I want to blame it in particular on John Schneider on after a game like this, or, you know, I tend to put most of the blame on the players themselves. And I guess if that is the case, then I guess the person you can blame will be Ross Atkins, right? Cause it's about him. If you find the fault with the players, then the truth is that this is the roster he constructed, right? So I think that reflects on him more than on the manager. But when it comes to analytics, I mean, of all the teams to say like analytics are like you lose the analytics battle against, I mean, the Rays are probably like the most analytics heavy team in like all of baseball. Maybe the Dodgers are next, but of course the Dodgers have the really good players to back it up. But I don't know. I'm not sure I would put the blame necessarily on analytics, but I do agree that to Joe's general point on like something needs to change. It does, I think, point to some kind of flaw with the process that you spend this much money on the payroll and only get like a 500 level ball club.
Yeah, there's a couple of things out of the front office. One of them is that I do think there's a bit of a misconception about the Jays being a huge analytics team, because for one, everybody is at this point. Like analytics are huge in baseball. People have a decent sized staff of these guys, regardless of what team they are. I think that because of the way Atkins and Shapiro present themselves, people then believe yes. that they're extremely into analytics. Yes. And it's like, that's more than the actual truth. As you pointed out, the Rays more sophisticated, Astros, Dodgers, yada, yada, yada. You could go on. I don't think the Jays are really special in any direction there. And then the other thing about building the ball club, you know, inefficiently, having to spend this much for yeah. kind of middling talent, like that is a player development failure. Beyond Bo and Vladdy and Kirk, they have not, and Manoah to some extent, although that's been a bumpy road, they have not been able to graduate quality big league players. And so they have to go out and pay for them. So then they're going out and paying for declining veterans who are decent, but not necessarily extraordinary, and paying the market rate for them. That's how you get an expensive team that is not particularly good.
Yeah, I think you can solve a lot of problems with money in professional sports. I'm not sure you can solve every problem every single year with money. Like, I think it always just felt that, you know, getting that sexy free agent, which is fun. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, it's definitely one of my favorite parts of the offseason, looking at the free agent market. But I think that's typically as being the finishing touch, right, for a club that is ready to take the next step or make the playoffs or whatever, bring in the right guys but doing that every single season, and you're just throwing money at the problem. And I mean, I talked about this on a couple episodes ago during one of the night games, but I mean, you know, like the rotation is something that's going to have to be filled. Like, if Bassett leaves and you need to fill the fifth spot still, because Scherzer is going to leave almost certainly, and you're not sure about Baden Francis, then like you really only have Gosman Berríos for next year. And let's just assume they're on the team next year. There are scenarios in which you could trade Gosman, I suppose, if the bottom really falls out. But let's just, for the sake of this conversation, say that Gosman and Berríos are part of the starting rotation next year. It is, when it comes to apart from like Bo and like Kyle Tucker, let's say, the best free agents in next year's class are all pitchers. So in theory, you could solve that problem with money, but I'm not sure you can do that every single year. It doesn't seem quite sustainable.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you're seeing this season, is sort of the result of that mindset. And to be fair, they're doing it because they have to do
right,
it. It's
right.
not like this. It's not like this is what they would have wanted for themselves. But the reason they have to do it is because of failures elsewhere in the organization, whether you want to call it drafting or player development, inability to bring in effective young players. They've put themselves in a position where they're like, if we want to compete at all, we need to spend a lot of money. And that's, it's kind of funny because it feels like for a lot of Blue Jays history, kind of early 21st century history, they could develop players and they couldn't really afford to run a competitive payroll compared to what the Yankees and Red Sox are doing. And now the script has flipped where they can afford to have a big payroll and they can really be in the market for quality free agents, but they can't develop internally. And it sounds very simple. And if it were this simple, everyone would do it, but to be a truly class franchise, you have to do both. You have to be able to develop players. You have to be able to get players in free agency and trade. Like, this is what the Los Angeles Dodgers do. It's not rocket science. You spend a bunch of money, but you also develop really good ball players. Hard to do, but you can't have only one of those things working.
416-870-0590, 1-888-666-0590, *590 on your cell. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Kitchener, where Jay joins us here on Jay's Talk. Jay, what's up?
If you go back just a couple of years, in fact, it might be last year, Tampa started the season 13-0, and you know who beat them?
Yeah, the Jays, yeah.
Yeah, so it is what it is. One game does not define a season. And in other years, I'd be worried about the Blue Jays, but you look at the American League, and they're not exactly running away with it.
So what do you think, Jay? What's your outlook for the rest of the season? Because I agree with you. I tend to agree that one season does not indicate what's going to happen for the rest of the season. That was the case after the Padres series, and it's the case after this series too. But what's your outlook for this team this year? I'm just curious.
Well, every day I expect a loss and hope I'm wrong, and I just hope for the best. I'm blind as well as in a wheelchair. I love listening to Blue Jay Baseball, and I'm really thankful you guys made the phone line available today.
All right. Well, Jay, appreciate you calling in, man.
Talk.
Yeah, thanks for joining us here on Jay's Talk, Jay. Well, you know what? I appreciate his outlook because hope for like expect a loss and hope for the best.
I think that means a very healthy way to approach the Toronto Blue Jays and baseball in general. Do not put yourself in a position to be disappointed. Enjoy the good moments. Don't let the bad moments get you.
Let's keep going on the phones. Let's go to Detroit, where Mark joins us from Detroit. Mark, welcome to Jays Talk. What's on your mind?
I got a. I don't know if you can find the stat, but if there's a way to figure out what opposing starters' ERAs are against the Blue Jays, they don't seem to hit them. And Dan Shulman said something today. It was like, I think a fourth inning. And the aside on this is I have Pepiot in my fantasy team. And I told one of my buddies, you're going to have a great game today because he's facing the Jays. And he goes out and does it. They make everyone look like Cy Young. And he said, you know, I think in the fourth inning, he's like 43 of the 62 pitches are strikes. And he's in the strike zone and they can't hit him. And it's every game like that. And there's got to be something that they're doing wrong approach-wise. I mean, obviously, that I think was the fourth or third inning where they had four pitches. You know, they just don't hit pitches in the strike zone. And every other team seems to come out with a lead against them, and it's frustrating to watch. You know, the underlying metrics of that Padres series, I bet if they looked at it, they won one game with three hits. They won another game late where Padres just self-destructed. It reminded me of that 2015, you know, the Batista bat flip inning. I think like Machado was playing Elvis Andrus role.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but they didn't really dominate that series the way you would think for a three game sweep. If you look at like how the games actually played out and, you know, they can't hit. It's frustrating.
Hey, I appreciate the call.
I don't know if anyone knows that stat or if there's a way to figure it out, but I would guarantee that ERA's got to be under two against them.
Yeah, thank you for the call, Mark. I appreciate it. It does feel that way, doesn't it, Nick? I mean, in this series, if you only look at this series, right, and you look at Drew Rasmussen in game one, Shane Baz in game two, and then Ryan Pepiot today, I mean, those are three of the Rays' better starters, certainly when they're healthy, right? Because if the whole rotation was healthy, Shane McClanahan would be in there and other guys as well. But, I mean, Rasmussen has been, when healthy, because he's encountered some injuries, has been one of the better Rays pitchers in all of, I mean, certainly in the last couple of years, I think dating back to like the pandemic season, essentially. I think the Baz start definitely left more for me to be desired. Not that I want to say tip your cap for Rasmussen, but Rasmussen has been so good and he was really good. Baz was really all over the place, right? Like he was a little wild, a lot of walks in that game. He would just lose command of the strike zone almost randomly, it would seem, then just remember that he could throw 99 mile an hour fastballs seconds later and then get out of it. So that felt like a missed opportunity. I'll say this too, to Mark's point, I mean, about Pepiot today, I mean, Pepiot was good, certainly, but it does feel like there were pitches left over the middle of the plate that they just, for whatever reason, couldn't catch up to today.
Yeah, and Pepiot's raw stuff is not necessarily on the same level as Shane Baz, and his refinement and sort of pitchability is not on the same level as Rasmussen. You do expect to get to him a little bit. To provide some of the numbers, I'd like to, you know, respond to the caller's request. We are there. We're there for them.
So did you find it?
Well, not exactly, okay, but I'll give you an approximation, okay, right. Something that is similar. So in the first five innings of games coming into today's game, the Toronto Blue Jays have 1.92 runs per game in the first five innings, okay. Just under two runs. That ranks 25th in the major leagues right now. And if they had done it last year, that would have ranked 29th. So that's kind of what we're talking about. In the first half of games, that's mainly when starters are in. The first five innings of a game, they are one of the very worst teams in baseball. We could break it down a little further. They're even worse in the first and second innings. So, as again, they're in this series we saw it, they did not put themselves in a position to get out in front. They were consistently chasing games. And when you're chasing games and offense is not your strength, it is really, really hard to win consistently.
Yeah, so it's just a tough watch because I think to Mark's point, it does feel like, and maybe it's just because we're all watching these games and not watching every other game that's going on at the same time, but it does feel like, Nick, that they make, and I don't think Ryan Pepiot is like some random guy, because when the trade happened that brought him from Los Angeles to the Rays, he was viewed as one of their better pitching prospects, right? So I think that he's kind of fulfilling the pedigree that he had as a prospect, and of course he pitched last year certainly as well and was pretty good. for the Rays. But my point being that it does feel like when the Jays do face like quote unquote random pitchers, they make them look like Cy Young. And it's funny because I think the way this team is pitched, I mean, they're gonna face, I believe the Rangers probable starting tomorrow are Jacob DeGrom, Eovaldi on Tuesday, and then Molly on Wednesday, all of whom have been very, very good so far this year. Honestly, like the way this season has gone, they are going to win two or three of those games on the road because, again, it's kind of hard to predict what this team has been doing lately.
It's a strange thing, right? You can watch this game. If you watched this game and it was the only game you'd watched all season, you'd say, how did they win any games before this? And how are they going to win any games after this? Like, they are not at a level to compete with these other MLB teams, especially, you mentioned those great pitchers that they're going to see. But that's just part of it where, you show up the next day, it's totally fresh, it's new, and you never know when you're going to kind of get over the hill, find something, some hitter gets really hot, What if Anthony Santander, for example, standing in for that 11-pitch at bat in the end, that was something that, raised his confidence and suddenly he got hot and hit two home runs on Monday? I'm not saying that's going to happen, but these are the things that do happen. Like, the idea of momentum is it's a finicky concept and it's hard to pin down. And I don't think because a team has a stinker of an outing, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're doomed to be in a rut for any amount of time.
416-870-0590, 1-888-666-0590, *590 on your cell. Those are the numbers to call. 590-590, name and location. A lot of texts we haven't gotten to, Nick. So let's do this. Let's take a quick break. Let's come back. We will go back to the text line, 590-590, name and location. Read all the texts or as many of them as we have not gotten to many of them. And also check out the Bet365 standings update as well. And if we have some time, we'll hear from the skipper, John Schneider, wrapping up his availability a couple moments ago. Blue Jays lose 13-0 to the Rays to wrap up a series sweep in Tampa, in Florida. We'll be back after this. You're listening to Blue Jays Talk. That's Nick. I'm Sho. We're back in a flash on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Seems like across the board, kind of finding that consistency has been a priority. What can teams do to just be more consistent?
I think just grind at bats, grind both offensively and defensively. Focus on kind of your approach and your game plan and what you're looking for. Focus on pitches. It's just focus on little things.
That is Chris Bassitt after the Blue Jays lose 13-0 to the Rays to wrap up a series sweep. I mean, he was asked about consistency. That was our friend Mitch Bannon asking the question. And he kind of talked about pitches to a certain extent, Nick, but it was kind of funny. Like, it does kind of sound like he was talking about, hey, like, grind out a couple more ABs there. I'm certain he's talking generally, but on a day where Bassitt was really laboring, and then, like we said, guys come out and just take some hacks at pitches for some very quick outs, it's hard not to have that visual in your mind when you're hearing Bassitt talk to the media there.
There's no way that he's pleased with how his teammates performed around him today. Now, to be clear, I don't think there's any way he's pleased with how he himself performed. Yeah. I don't think he's like throwing people under the bus in some aggressive way. But, when he mentions, do the little things and grind, like, those are chosen words. And the Jays did not do the little things in this game. Now, if they had done the little things perfectly, they still would have lost. I think they weren't close enough in the game where it was a couple of mistakes. I think about Jonathan Clase getting picked off, some of that. No effect on the outcome of the game. Like, the game wasn't close enough for those type of things to matter. But the Jays did look sloppy in this game, and it did cost them runs. It didn't necessarily cost them the win or the loss. They didn't come close to getting the win. But they did not put on a very professional performance overall. And that's notable to a guy like Bassitt, who is a veteran and he's a competitive guy, and he doesn't like to see that. And I think that's understandable.
That is Nick Ashbourne. I'm Sho Ali. You're, of course, listening to Jay's Talk here on the Sportsnet Radio Network. We're here until the bottom of the hour. So before we keep on taking your texts, 590-590, name and location, I wanted to get to the Bet365 standings update. With Bet365, you can watch thousands of live games, build your own bet. You can even make a bet while the game is still being played. 19-plus, play responsibly, Ontario only. So all of the games in the American League East, except for the Yankees game, are over. The Yankees game looks like it's in a delay right now, top of the fifth inning, but the Yankees are winning 4-2. But Having said that, the other games are over. The Baltimore Orioles did beat the Red Sox 5-1 at Fenway. And of course, we have our game, a 13-0 Rays win over the Blue Jays. So with all that being said, Nick, and again, like, the outcome of the Yankees game is not going to change a lot because the Yankees are still a number of games top the division. So either way, the Yankees are 31-20. The Rays now jump into second place in the division. They are 26-26. Half a game back of the Rays are the Red Sox. They are 27-28. The Blue Jays are in fourth place. They are 25-27. And despite the win, the Baltimore Orioles are 18-34. I mean, to go to one of the caller's points from the first half of the show, Nick, I mean, it still feels like an eminently gettable division. I also think the problem is when you look at other divisions, right, around the American League, I mean, you got the Central. So the Tigers are 34-20. The Guardians are 29-23, as are the Twins. And the Royals are 29-25. So, like, in theory, you could finish, like, if things hold the way they have been holding. And again, it's not that many games separating these teams. But if all of the Guardians, Twins, and Royals stay where they are, there could be a situation where you come in like second place in the American League East for the first time in forever and still don't make the playoffs because the three wildcard spots are taken up by teams from other divisions, which typically has not been the case, right? Like in the last couple of years, if you finished second in the American League East, you're probably making the playoffs.
We're so used to thinking of the AL East as this really, really difficult division. The presence of the Yankees, the Red Sox have been kind of inconsistent, but when they're on, they've generally had a high budget quality team. The Rays as this really innovative outfit that seems to punch above its weight. The Orioles with the amount of young talent they have. I mean, what's happened to the Orioles has been frankly shocking. This is a team that was expected to compete for a division title. And I'm not necessarily saying that this kind of middle clump of the AL East is much worse than the AL Central. I think that, there's some amount of feasting on the White Sox that happens. And I'm not a huge buyer on some of those clubs like the Guardians, for instance, or even the Royals necessarily. But the standings are what they are. And so you have to do significantly better than these teams if you want to make the playoffs. You need to be sort of 3-4 games better than them over the course of the season. That is not impossible because these are not juggernaut teams. But when we talk about the wild card race later in the year, and we'll see if the Blue Jays are in that race, that's not a given. But it might be more about how many teams you can overtake because I think everyone is going to be pretty close in the number of wins and losses. So you might be down, I don't know, let's call it 2.5 games later in the season. That makes you think you're close, but actually you need to overtake 3 or 4 teams, right? And that's what really could be a problem.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, like, the when you look at the wild card as well, I mean, it's not as though you're that far if you're even 25-27, but it's just I do think you can't fall any further than that between now and the trade deadline, because I mean, we've gotten some texts about, hey, you should get a jump on the trade deadline now. And I mean, not many teams do that this early in the season. Not even the Rockies have done that, right? And the Rockies are off like one of the worst starts you'll ever see from any team ever in the history of this very old sport, right? So I think and the reason for that is just not a lot of teams are willing to pay the asking prices this early in the season on players that are potentially up for trade, right? But I mean, if you fall a little further and the bottom falls out a little bit more, then that conversation might change as we get closer to like the end of July, for example. But anyways, that's just a quick look at the standings update. Let's go back to the text line though, Nick. 590-590, name and location. We got about 10-12 minutes before we get out of here. There's a text here from Pete in Halifax. And Pete says, why do the Jays pitch to Lau? And then in all caps, it's called the intentional walk. And now he texted this about 3 hours ago. So I'm guessing this came in like right after the home run. I gotta say, I don't think you're going to see too many intentional walks in the first inning of a ball game. Just like generally, like philosophically, I don't think you're going to see that happen too many times. But I do think, to go back to what we were talking about before, Brandon Lau has, again, over the course of a really small amount of games, 61 games, has hit his 20th home run today. So, I mean, you hope that doesn't continue going forward. Your point from earlier is valid that he hits Bassett particularly well, and Bassett in his availability, when he was asked about it, said he's a low ball pitcher. Lau is a low ball hitter. So he seemed to distill it into a very simple sentiment, but you're probably not seeing too many intentional walks in the first inning.
Yeah. I mean, for a little context here, Lau has been walked intentionally twice in the last 4 seasons combined. Like, that's not how the league treats him. He is a very good player. We saw how that worked today in terms of the way he hit the ball against the Blue Jays and against Bassett. But he is not a true blue superstar in that way where you consider walking him in kind of almost any situation. But the league's thinking on this has changed a lot. Like, Aaron Judge, this season has been about as unstoppable as you can be with the bat. Like, he's been in that prime Barry Bonds zone. He's been walked intentionally 9 times in 51 games. And it's just the reality where giving away a free base is a very high price to pay when even against the best players in the sport, you are significantly more likely to get the out than give up any kind of damage. That's just the way the math works on it. So the intentional walks, we see them more often in extra innings now, with a guy in second base to create more opportunities for outs, things like that. But it's just not a weapon. A weapon is probably the wrong way to use it. It's not a tactic that you're going to that early in the game or that often against a player who is not one of the elite hitters in the sport.
Yeah, like the last time I feel like we had a really dedicated conversation about this was when like Shohei Ohtani came to the Rogers Center and was like banging pitches, and what was it, Matt Chapman was yelling at John Schneider in the dugout, like, why are you pitching to him, right? It's like those are the kinds of players I think you can have these conversations about. And I mean, I don't know. Brandon Lau, he's very good. And I mean, he's good enough that if the Rays themselves don't pull it together and get up to a more playoff ready spot, I mean, he might be dealt the deadline depending on how the Rays view him. But I mean, yeah, I just wanted to bring that up because I thought that was interesting. Jay from Regina says on the text line, show, can we stop being disappointed when the Jays lose? The Jays are a 500 team that have 1/3 of their starting lineup as bench players. They only have 3 starters that are able to pitch quality starts, hitters that can hit home runs and choke with runners in scoring position, all while carrying a top 5 payroll. They are a 500 team and we shouldn't expect anything more. The more you realize that, the better off you're going to be. I do think that's like a somewhat glass half empty view of what the Jays are, considering that, again, like not that long ago, we did see them sweep a series against a very good ball club in the Padres. But at the same time, this general idea from Jay saying they're a 500 team is, I think, true. I think a lot of fans expect more than a 500 team with a top 5 payroll. Absolutely. So I'll disagree with you there. But I do agree with the assessment that this team is like closer to being 500 than they are to being like a team that's going to win the division, for example.
Your mental health will probably be better if you perceive them, yeah, in that zone of a coin flip to win on a given game, which that is a 500 team. Also, I think the payroll thing, and we touched on a little bit before the break, like that is a little bit deceptive. Just because you have a payroll that's high, it does not mean the quality of the talent on the team is that high. People get paid a lot of money or less money depending on context. Like you reach free agency, you have an open market for your services, you get a lot of money. Or you could be a player who's a first or second year player and you make the minimum. Well, that player making the minimum, think about Jackson Merrill, who came through town with the San Diego Padres. That's a superstar caliber player who makes the minimum. So just because a team has a top 5 payroll doesn't necessarily mean that they have top 5 talent.
Right.
And the Jays are not close to that. And again, that's due to failings in the front. I'm not saying that this is something they should be, you know, forgiven for, but that's the failings of this front office to develop and graduate young talent has led to the situation where the amount of money on the team is not equal to the amount of talent on the team. They're forced into using free agency as an inefficient tool to build this roster. And yeah, it is not, it's not even close to a top 5 roster. This is a mushy middle of the major leagues type of roster, and it's just a very expensive version of that.
Alex in Ottawa on the text line says, do you guys think it's more pitching woes or hitting futility that's going to make the difference between being buyers and sellers by the trade deadline? I am working hard to be optimistic this season. I think it's a valid question, mainly because at different times, both of those things have gone wrong, right? I mean, sometimes the pitching has been really, really good and the bats have not been able to score. At times, the bats have been terrific and the pitching has been abysmal. At times, the starting rotation and the bats have been going and then the bullpen gets knocked around. It rarely feels like there have been long stretches, to Alex's point, Nick, where all three phases of the team are working well in conjunction with each other all at the same time.
If we're going to indulge in being a little bit glass half full for a second, like when I think about that question, I think about proceeding ahead with the team into the playoffs, which again feels very far away at this particular minute. Yeah. But when you're talking about a playoff situation, you can massage the pitching aspect a little bit. You can shorten your rotation. You can use trusted guys in the bullpen in particular. I think of the 2019 Washington Nationals, who felt like it was just like Strasburg and Scherzer and a bunch of spare parts from a pitching, Corbin, to be fair, and a bunch of spare parts on the pitching side. It's easier to massage that, where like the lineup, they got to go out there 1-9 and they have to hit in order, and there's nothing you can really do about that. So if you have a lineup that's really devoid with offense, it is hard to work around that in any way, shape, or form. And so at the end of the day, if I'm a Blue Jays team that is around the trade deadline and hoping to improve and potentially make the playoffs and just hope to make some kind of run, it's offense that I probably end up targeting because it's just unavoidable. And when you have black holes in your lineup, that is really problematic against especially elite quality teams that you would see later on.
Jimmy from Dundas texts in to say, do you expect the Jays to make a move to get a quality hitter? And I mean, if they hover around 500, I mean, I think they'll at least explore it, right? But it just does feel like there are probably too many, I don't want to say too many holes to be filled in one by one trade deadline, because, you know, but at the same time, how many teams really go all in at the trade deadline? The other part of it too is a hitter that would make a real difference, I think, Nick, would probably command the best prospects from an already, like, relatively speaking, weak pool. Like, I'm not sure anyone would be that excited to Band-Aid the problem if it meant trading, like, Arjun Namala or Treya Savage, for example. And I just use them as examples because they have been some of the hotter prospects recently, right? And, I mean, I don't think I would be, frankly, if it meant you have to trade Namala to get, like, someone who is maybe going to fix that issue. At the same time, I mean, I do feel like when you have a payroll this size, I mean, you probably do have some sort of a fiduciary duty to, like, yourselves, to the fans, to the players, to, like, try and give them a chance. But I mean, not if they're, like, going to be below 500 basically all season.
Yeah, I think you're thinking more a 2016 trade deadline than a 2015 trade deadline where they were close to 500, but they had a lot of talent and they had a really high run differential. They had reasons to believe that the team was better than the record showed. I don't know if you'll get to a situation like that with this team. It's hard to say. They're a couple months ahead. Things could change. But if you're hovering around the playoff picture, that's a situation you're in, then it's hard to be that team and also simultaneously be the team that is good enough that you want to push your chips in and say, this is the year, this is our run, we're willing to sacrifice some of our future to do it. And the Jays don't have the luxury of a super deep farm system where you say, you know what, maybe this is a silly year to push in, but let's push in because we've got an embarrassment of riches down on the farm and we might as well try it. We've got some veteran players. The Jays just aren't in that position.
No, exactly. I'm not sure. I tend to believe, and I believe this about a lot of different sports, but I tend to believe that trading draft picks and prospects are, you know, if it's worth the gamble for the player that you're getting back, I think generally speaking, you should at least think about it. And for the most part, it tends to work out. But I don't know where the Jays are right now. I'm not sure. I mean, you talked about the idea that this team has had somewhat of a failure to draft and develop players, whatever you want to call it. And if you believe that, even if you believe that things could turn around, I'm not sure you want to start this, like, next year, for example, by trading away, like, two of your essentially best prospects, right? Like, in Namala and Savage case, I think they are 1 and 2 in some order, right? So do you really want to start there for just a chance, not even to win the division, but, like, just a chance to, like, get back in the wild card race? Personally, I think that would be a somewhat mismanagement of assets.
Yeah, this team is headed for maybe not a full rebuild, especially with Vladdy on his big extension. You do have a player that you're building around to some extent. But with Bichette's situation, Bassett's situation, guys getting older, like, this team is headed towards at least a retool of some sort after 2025. And when you embark on that, you want to have some of these young players in your back pocket that you feel really good about. They may still bust, but you want to feel really good about a couple guys that you can imagine being tent poles of your future, and putting that in jeopardy for a run with kind of a middle of the pack team probably isn't the best way to do it.
Before we get out of here, Nick, expectations for the Rangers series. You have 3 games against the Rangers. Again, I said the probables are DeGrom, Eovaldi, and Maley. And then you got the 4-gamer against the Athletics at home that begins on Thursday. So no off days until not tomorrow, but the following Monday. But what are your expectations for the last little bit of this mini road trip?
Based on the tough starters in Texas, I think it might be a 1 of 3. It might be a 1 of 3. And then I think your hope is that you make it up in the Athletics series and you win at least 3 of those 4 games.
Yeah, I think you kind of need to win 3 of 4 games against the A's. And I mean, the A's right now, they are 22-31. So, you know, they've been worse recently,
to be fair. They came out of the gates surprisingly respectable, and now they're kind of showing themselves to be one of those seller sort of teams. So when that kind of team shows up on the schedule, that is a big opportunity, and the Jays need to take that opportunity.
Nick, we don't get to do this often enough, but it is always fun when I get to hang out with you during the game and do the pre and posts with you. So thanks again for joining me.
It was my pleasure. Look forward to being back.
That is Nick Ashbourne. I'm Sho Ali. Blue Jays baseball brought to you by the local family-owned Crownus Control Centers in Antigonish and New Glasgow, Nova Scotia. Crownus proud to be Canadian-owned and operated since 1986. Protect your vehicle from rust today at your local Crownus Control Center or visit crown.com. Crown. Canada's number one rust protection. For Nick, for Ben Shulman, Chris LaRue, Tom Young, Nick Blackmore, I'm Sho. That does it for us this weekend. We are out of here. Blair and Barker will handle the Rangers series, the first two games of the A's series. I'm back next weekend for Saturday and Sunday as usual. I hope the rest of your weekend is better than this game. We'll talk to you later.